Welcome back to the M&A Zing, the weekly podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders and holdco builders across the UK and Europe. This week, straight from an amazing weekend in Fontainebleau at the INSEAD 2025 ETA conference, which brought together almost 400 established and aspiring acquisition entrepreneurs, search investors, MBA students and supporters for an insightful day of discussion, knowledge sharing, networking. What a wonderful weekend we had in a beautiful setting of the INSEAD campus near Paris. We're going to shortly dive into an exciting interview with an amazing acquisition entrepreneur who has recently completed his acquisition and is here to share his journey with us. So, but first, let's get into this week's news. A few items that may have escaped your attention. RDCP, led by Samir Rizvi and Irina Dublowska, have acquired Monarch Healthcare, an operator of 13 freehold nursing homes, which has indexed their holdco once again towards the care space, making RDCP Care the lion's share of their diversified portfolio. But congratulations to them on what must have been a fairly complex transaction. Over to Spain, we see Triari Capital, led by Luis Diaz Rodriguez Arias and backed by a number of investors, including Daniel Largo at Visa, has begun his search for a 1 million to 3.5 million euro EBITDA SMB in the Iberian Peninsula. So we wish Luis the best of luck in success. And then something I recommend to your reading, Search Fund News has published its end of Q1 2025 report, which reviews 20 searcher-led acquisitions globally that took place so far this year, of which 45% have been in Europe. And of those European deals, about 45% have been in Spain specifically, whilst the UK, Germany and Netherlands comprise most of the remainder. Key takeaways, the main active verticals continue to be industrials, B2B services, software and healthcare. So get on Search Fund News and have a read of that. It certainly tells you what the road ahead looks like for 2025. So that's the news. Today, we are speaking with someone who has navigated the full arc of entrepreneurship through acquisition, from preparation and search to acquisition and now operation. Sebastian Willen is the searcher behind Profectus Capital and now the managing director of Vistafolia, a company that he recently acquired. His journey is fascinating, involving a top-tier start as a consultant at Bain, followed by a very intentional decade building diverse leadership experience across business development, marketing, and large-scale operations at companies like IWG and Regus and Shopee, including nearly 7 years based in Asia before embarking on his search here based in London, UK. He's now applying all of that wealth of experience to leading Vistafolia, the company that he acquired in recent months. So, Sebastian, welcome to the show and great to see you again, sir.
Thanks for the warm introduction, Gareth.
So let's start with your intentional path, as I mentioned. You moved on from Bain and you spent 10 years in leadership roles, including at IWG, and spent most of the time in Asia. Was it always your intention to get into entrepreneurship through acquisition?
Yes and no. I think I realized quite early on during my strategy consultant years that I didn't want to become a corporate citizen for life. But at the same time, I realized that on the one hand, my risk profile wasn't high enough and I didn't have an idea yet to start my own business. So those two meant that to start the entrepreneurial journey at that point in time was just not feasible. So and at the same time, my uncle in Belgium, he bought what many would consider a boring business. He bought a paint business, and it sort of opened my eyes that it's not all about starting a business. There's a lot of potential in acquiring a business, and I named it myself Mini Private Equity. So I was on this journey to at some point in time do a mini private equity acquisition. But after only 2 years of consulting experience, I didn't feel like I had the baggage, the knowledge to go on that journey. I wouldn't have been very credible. So I picked, I found IWG, which is the umbrella company of Regus, the service office space provider. And I was lucky enough to over the course of, I believe it was 7 years, be part of different corporate functions. So the first year I set up a new business unit with my then manager. I then was asked to move into the marketing organization, which I had absolutely no experience in, but I worked on social media, so working directly with Facebook and LinkedIn and Google. I was then asked to move to Malaysia to run the local marketing efforts there. And after about 3 years in marketing, I realized, oh, I'm becoming a marketeer, which is not the goal. So I asked to change again into a more commercial role, and I led the global P&L of some different services that we offer to our customers. Then I took a step back again and realized what am I missing? What do I not feel confident and comfortable with? And that was really the operational part, managing bigger teams than 5 to 20 people that I had led before. And so I found that challenge in Shopee, which is best described as Southeast Asia's Amazon, where I led the Malaysia operations team that focused on customer service and the return and refund process, which was managing over 1,000 people, mostly customer service agents. But it posed its own challenges. And then finally, in my last stage before I started really my ETA journey, I stick to Shopee, but I led their Malaysia business development team to sort of close the loop and also have that had that more salesy experience.
So really, really intentional, really self-aware of you to have gone down this road of preparing yourself and looking at areas where you felt you needed to step outside your comfort zone and augment your skill set, and taking that leap out of the corporate with IWG and into Shopee, albeit it's a large firm, but maybe more a younger firm than IWG's decades of establishment, but deliberately going out and looking for a 1,000+ workforce team to manage is certainly a great way to baptize yourself by fire. What did you learn from having that many heads and reporting lines?
Less is better. Don't do what I mean, I wouldn't do what I believe Jensen Huang has something like 35 direct reports. I don't think I'm the right person to mirror his model, but it's until that point in time I was always more strategic, and at that point in time it just becomes like making small improvements can actually have huge impact in already the short term, because you're talking volume, which was really interesting. And then of course the people aspect becomes a lot more important, making sure you have, because there are multiple management levels you're managing, so making sure that you have the right people, the right managers at the right place, is key as well, I think, to succeed.
100%. Yep. Spoken from true experience. So you've been on this self-development journey in your career path, and then something sparked in you to go and begin the search to buy a company. Want to talk us through what the final catalyst was to launch Perfectus Capital and head on into the world of acquisition entrepreneurship?
Yes, of course. I still remember it very clearly. It was about a year before we more or less knew we were going to move back from Malaysia to the UK. And I knew I was going to embark on what I was still calling the mini private equity journey. And in my mind, that was buying a mediocre or slightly below mediocre company that is somewhat in distress, buying it for pennies on the dollar. And because I'm genius, I'm going to, of course, do well. But that, of course, completely changed. I was talking to a Wharton MBA graduate about my mini private equity idea, and he immediately said, "Oh, you mean a search fund?" And I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. But I believe the day after I started to delve into that world and I went full circle. The first couple of weeks, I was convinced I was going to do a traditional partnered search because you get it's less risky, it's more fun. You have two people, it's more, and it just sounded nice, right? Less risk, more brain power. So happy days. As I spoke to more and more people in the industry, that being searchers, investors, advisors, it became clear that, and this is my own personal assessment, that once you do partnered, you need bigger deals to make the commercials work. When you stick to traditional, it has very clear criteria you stick to. Not easy to diverse from them. So eventually, after about, I think, half a year, I decided that self-funded, and I'll do it myself, is so a solo self-funded search is the right thing for me. And I kicked that off roughly in May 2024, I believe, whilst I was still in Malaysia. So that wasn't it was a soft launch, I would say. That's when it really started.
So you chose the self-funded option very wisely. That kind of dials in the sort of size of business that one can typically target. And you mentioned there that you set out to initially acquire a distressed business and do a turnaround. That's not actually what you've subsequently bought, by the sounds of it. But we'll get into that in a moment. You've bought something far healthier, far far more burgeoning.
Luckily,
With...
luckily.
Well, quite. Yeah, but it's impressive that you set out with that determination that perhaps you could do a turnaround job. I think if we set that expectation in ourselves, then we don't get disappointed by the candidates that we find. But you've gone from initially taking that first tentative step, part-time searching whilst in full-time employment in a different country, to less than a year later, having got the acquisition target found, funded, negotiated, deal over the line, and you're sat there in the MD's office operating it. So fantastic journey in such an accelerated time frame just demonstrates that with concerted effort, actually it is achievable, and there's an abundance of opportunities out there if you grasp them. So tell us a little bit then about Vistafolia, the acquisition journey. How did you find them? What was the sort of negotiation like, if you can speak to without betraying confidence, sort of deal structuring and possibly the due diligence process? What did you discover along the way, and how did you get it from on paper to over the line?
That's a lot of questions. Do you have time? All right, where do I start? I first saw this company, or I believe it was May. It was one of the first ones I ever looked at, even. It was through a broker, and I still remember my dad's an architect, and I remember him sending him a message saying, "Hey, what do you think of this?" Because it just, whilst it didn't fit many of the criteria I had set out for myself, it just sparked a level of interest. Like, oh, it's an extremely niche product. It's playing in the premium segment of this niche market that's clearly growing. But because it was a little bit smaller, well, quite a bit smaller than I initially set my target EBITDA for, I didn't give it more than a couple of looks, and I didn't have an initial conversation. So just for clarity, I was looking for $1.5 million EBITDA and above, because you have proper management in place. It's enough to get investors interested, because they can get a decent enough slice of the pie, and the same goes for any debt. I then, over the summer, realized that I'm still looking for a needle in a haystack, and I want to expand my search a little bit. And what that meant for me was, still anything above $1.5 million is ideal, but if I can go significantly below that, so somewhere between $500,000 and 750, I can fund the acquisition more or less myself, if the multiple isn't all that high. And that opened up then a lot more opportunities. And I revisited Vistafolia. I started having conversations with many different companies, of which Vistafolia was one. and really just liked those conversations. I liked, still like the owner or the seller of the company. It became clear that they have a superior product. I visited the company, not the people, didn't get introduced to the people, but visited their offices and saw the product, and I was really impressed. Now, what I had to do then was, okay, do I go for it or not? And what became clear quite quickly was that getting any debt was going to be very hard, for the simple reason that well, not the majority, but a big chunk of their revenue comes from outside of the UK. And as far as I understand, a lot of the private debt funds have a mandate to support the UK economy. And when you generate a lot of business outside of the UK, they can't really fund you. And it was not really a me problem, but
It's part of the ecosystem. I mean, I think there's an element of that with the Growth Guarantee Scheme loans that they are kind of to an extent mandated, but there is a risk aversion around companies heavily dependent on overseas jurisdictions, you know, where they can't necessarily enforce stuff in a UK court for collections purposes, and you can't just, you know, go and use the apparatus that exists in the UK. It becomes l less attractive to both traditional lenders and you know, the debt funds, as you mentioned. Sorry to interrupt, but yes. So,
No, totally.
and a lot of folks
Now,
are going to find this with these small quantum type deals by comparison. You know, a lot of the commercial finance space in the UK is geared up towards, you know, 2, 3 million and above deal values. So it's a tradition, it's a typical challenge to try and find good finance to get these deals done. How did you overcome that problem?
just to be clear, we're just a UK entity. It's just that a lot of business is generated overseas, and that was enough for the. I mean, there may be 10 at most, 10 debt providers that would consider supporting an acquisition for a business under 1 million EBITDA, and then with the complication of having that overseas revenue. I believe almost all, if not all, were out of the picture. So I still really liked the company, and I put on a valuation on it that I thought was fair. Looked into my own pocket, how much I can fund myself. I don't think it was the right business to attract additional investors into, and it would reduce the ROI over time as well. So, I said, here's what I have. Here's what I think your business is worth. Let's find a structure that works for both of us. And we started negotiating, we started talking, and eventually we came to something that both of us were happy with. And so it's basically myself and the seller funding the acquisition.
Interesting. So, when you say funding, the sellers retain some equity, or as
No, it's a seller
committed,
note.
it's a seller note. Okay. Now, when we talk about seller notes in the UK, the convention has been interest-free deferred consideration. However, the influence of the US and other markets where interest is applied to these kinds of arrangements, we're seeing more deals like this getting done with a clip, with a coupon to the seller. What was that, if you are able to share, was that something that was in the negotiations in your case?
It was definitely part of the negotiation. The way we got around it is basically the speed of repayment is dependent on the performance of the business
Great.
with some buffer, right? To make sure that there's always some working capital retained for to fuel growth. Until that there's no seller note anymore, in my opinion, it wouldn't be fair for me to walk away with, or for the business to retain a lot of money. So that's how we got
Sure.
around that. No coupon, but accelerated payments paid off, dependent on the performance of the business.
Wonderful. So each party sharing some risk there. The seller is able to get paid out more rapidly if the business grows, as you'd both hope it would. But in the event that it doesn't, it just gets paid over a elastic period of time, I imagine.
Correct.
What
Yeah, I mean,
did you
it's
set a
set to five
horizon? Did,
years.
5 years.
Should be five.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, equally, I'd be very disappointed if I wouldn't be able to repay this in 5 years.
Exactly right. So that requires a motivated seller, right? This sort of arrangement in a small business where there's a heavy emphasis on the deferred consideration or a conditional earnout, that requires a motivated seller. So had they other business activities that they wished to go and pursue, or was it a retirement age question, as we see so often?
Yeah, it was quite inspirational in a way. I mean, you see so many business owners working 70 hours a week until they're 75 and they haven't enjoyed life. Here the seller is a little bit younger, and he just wants to enjoy life, I suppose. So he wanted to sell. I think the other consideration for your viewers and listeners is oftentimes there's more or less cash left in the business, and selling your business is the tax efficient way, or there are tax efficient ways to extract that cash out of the business, because it can then be capital gains instead of a dividend or worse, like salary, right?
Absolutely. No,
So
we want this
that could
seller. We
be a
want all the
motivation as
sellers.
well.
All sellers should be able to benefit from the business asset disposal relief. We still get that 1 million lifetime discounted CGT piece. It's still whatever it is, 14% now under Rachel Reeves, but it's still better than the 24% that you pay on the sum above that. So if all of
Correct.
this can be treated as deferred consideration, and it's done in a way that the individuals are being paid out for their efforts as a CGT. Sorry, as a capital gain, then all the better for everyone, arguably. So
Correct.
glad to hear that potentially the seller was able to structure it that way in Vistafolia's case.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, his motivations were clear, and I just wanted a fair deal where it was clear I wasn't trying to squeeze the lemon. All I was trying to, like, I want it's in our it's in both of our benefit, repay him as soon as possible.
Absolutely. You're motivated to come in and grow this business, which should be to everyone's benefit, right? And of course, that requires an element of trust from the seller, and you're an incredibly trustworthy person, hugely competent and credible in running this business, given your personality and your career history. So I'm sure that that was the area that you had to really overemphasize on, is making sure that you had trust in the seller and they had trust in you, and that this felt like a partnership to some extent, because you're tied together for up to 5 years there. So
It's
any
definitely that. Now there are also structures in place to just in case that I do extremely stupid things and burn the business down to the ground, that he's somewhat protected, just like a bank would, just like a bank would be. It's I'd like to think it's a good deal for both of us.
It sounds like an exemplary deal, and it sounds like the sort of deal that many aspiring self-funded searchers could take lessons from, because there are an abundance of businesses of this sort of size with this kind of demographic of motivated seller for whom this kind of deal structure is an ideal solution to the absence of good commercial finance at this level. So glad to hear you made it work. You almost achieved what many believe to be impossible. So congratulations to you. What has the adjustment been like coming from the corporate world to running Vistafolia now? What were the first few things that you encountered in terms of the way of working that maybe you had to adjust to?
Don't get any emails after 6. That's true. My time, like, I still work fairly long hours, but my time after 6 is my time, and I can focus solely on the things that I want to focus on. Whereas, depending on which company you work for, that's not the case. The other things are sort of what you would expect. It's really all hands on deck. You're juggling a lot of different balls in a lot of different functions. We're revamping our marketing, products that have been made for 10 years. You'd think production is a breeze, but you still need to focus so much on guaranteeing the quality, especially because we're selling a premium product. So it's, yeah, that quality, that QC process is so important. For the rest, I tried to live by the mantra of don't change too many things in the first year of your acquisition. So I'm not trying to change the world. We're currently moving away from sort of an old-ish accounting software and integrating Xero, which is more future-proof, I assume. We're working with Pipedrive instead of Excel sheets to track our sales progress. So it's not changing the world, but mainly making it in a way a little bit easier to run the business moving forward. So it's those small changes. Yeah.
Nice, necessary kind of adoption of popular cloud-based tooling. That's often where acquisition entrepreneurs put their emphasis is, you know, can we get these businesses running on rails that scale and rails that aren't, you know, don't have a platform risk and all that kind of stuff. So you're moving off of hosted on-premises Sage, for example, to cloud-based Xero.
That was it. Open
options. There you are. Yeah. So how's your sentiment? How are you feeling? Like the deal was completed when?
Mid February.
February, right. So month four. How's
yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Doesn't feel like it.
Feels like week four.
Exactly. No, I feel great. It's very strange that on Sundays I can't wait to look at my emails again, and Sunday evening, that is. Can't wait for Monday to start, basically, because there are many things on my plate and on everyone's plate in the company, and it's all exciting stuff. And even though, as I mentioned, a lot of our business is overseas, and we just had to go through the Trump tariffs, again, a lot of our business is with the US, and we manufacture in China. So when tariffs are 148%, that poses quite a big challenge for our business. But we stayed calm, and now that it's at a more reasonable level, not yet reasonable, but more reasonable, we're definitely more than back in business with those customers as well. So I'm really pumped up. I'm very happy with the team that I have. So happy day so far.
Really great to hear that. And again, what a wonderful exemplar of the sort of end game. You know, many people that are in the knee deep in search will be delighted to hear that, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and actually that light is warming and jubilant, and actually it is operating is a joy. That is the goal that we all cling to, I think, during the search process. So I'm really glad to hear that that's been your experience. But you mentioned there about the Trump tariffs and some operational headwinds that maybe are needing navigating. How are you feeling about the road ahead there?
Really good. I think with the Trump tariffs, we managed to navigate them. I think even if they stayed as high as they were, which was unlikely, I think we would have found ways for our customers to still sell our products by changing our shipping terms, for example, and making at the moment, it's a bit technical, but at the moment our customers pay us X works and they take care of the shipping, so they pay tariffs on the full amount. If we would import for them, we would pay tariffs on our production costs, basically, which would be significantly less. So that's one way we could have navigated that challenge.
Mitigating the tariffs to an extent by factoring out the margin.
Exactly that. So that was what I realized, that that was totally fine at 60% tariffs. When you get to 150%, even then, it becomes a challenge. Not something we couldn't overcome, but definitely a challenge. But yeah, we continue to focus on product development, which is something that really makes this company unique. A lot of our competitors, they buy off-the-shelf products from China and then sell it. Like, they might brand it and then resell it. I mean, you see it behind me. We have an R&D facility where we develop our own products, and then we work, and then we manufacture them and we sell them. So it's all unique products. And so we listen to our customers. What are we missing? And then we figure out a way to develop it. So far, I look at the future quite positively, but we'll see what it brings.
So it's a fairly globalized operation. You mentioned there earlier that your revenues are largely from around the world, not purely in the UK. And clearly, you've got a globalized manufacturing base there with production in Asia. So the core team are UK based in terms of
Yes.
commercial, business development, marketing, finance, etc.
Correct. Yeah, we're all in the UK. We do make, but we have a person in China that takes care of quality control. But for the rest, at the moment, we are solely UK based.
Fabulous. And how have they adjusted to having a new owner? Because I imagine a number will have had, years of working with the seller. What's the reception been like from the workforce?
I'll give you my perspective. That might not be their perspective. I mean, as far as I can tell, really well. As you can imagine, given that the seller was already contemplating or strongly considering retiring, he had spent less and less time together with the team, and I think it was a welcome new level of energy, just having someone there to brainstorm with, to help guide them. I think everyone really appreciates that, and I'd like to think that my leadership style is very collaborative. I don't like managers that think they're the smartest person on every subject in the room. Those are the ones that I didn't get along with. Luckily, didn't have too many of those, but I see my job as enabling a conversation and then reaching a conclusion rather than imposing to-dos on the team.
That must be a lovely culture to establish or to continue, whereby the workforce feel valued and able to contribute and drive the direction of the company. And certainly, that's the secret to scaling often in a human-centric business is make sure you've got people there you can trust and delegate to that want to be part of the solution. And great to see that playing out. So, if you had any advice for new acquirers, successful searchers who have got their deals over the line, what could you offer to someone facing those initial months of operation? What wisdoms might you pass on?
I don't think I'm going to say anything new here, but listen and observe before acting is probably the most important one. Don't change something that isn't broken. I'd say that's there's nothing more important in those initial couple of months, because you didn't, like, hopefully you didn't buy a business that's broken. When I mentioned that earlier, that was me and my in my early days, when I thought, like, oh, a turnaround sounds kind of fun, I would have never done it now. I now know that it's much better to buy a really solid business, and you make your money or your wealth through leverage and through growth of that steady business rather than betting on the turnaround. But yeah, listen.
Nice. Listening is certainly key in that people-centric culture. But from what you said there about believing that energy would be well spent in a turnaround and that would deliver the upside, actually being able to deploy that same energy into an established business and not be firefighting, but be able to, you know, do value creation with a stable foundation, that is a fundamentally different task, but maybe one that leads to a happier life along the way.
For sure, for sure. Having done a few transformations back in the day, those are usually not the most fun, and it's much more risky, right? You're taking a gamble that you're going to be able to pull it off, whereas if you buy something that's already doing well, it's the risk profile is so much lower.
Indeed. Now, I'd love to get into ETA more generally with you as an asset class in a sec, because yeah, you and I first met like mid last year, beginning of your search journey, and you know, at that time you were also exploring other avenues, other ETA opportunities. I just before we move into that, I'd love to just hear from you a reflection on you know, the last 12 months, whether you'd like to have done anything differently. You know, if looking back now through the lens, and it must have happened, you know, in a flash, but is there anything that you've learned that maybe you would go back and do differently?
I think I've been incredibly lucky, to be honest. I've always, I think that the change I made over the summer to be open to slightly smaller deals, to doing like that, just massively increased, I think, the likelihood of being successful, i.e. acquiring a company. So my strong recommendation for the people that can would be to go the self-funded route, maybe more so in the UK than outside of the UK, just because you have so much competition from private equity that plays really in the small cap market already, and that has just increased my likelihood of success. Just be more open to looking at non-traditional search companies. I mean, Vistafolio doesn't tick a lot of the boxes. Like, there's no recurring revenue. There's repeat revenue, which in many instances actually is more sticky than recurring, because people come back because they like your product, not because you tie them into long-term agreements. There's definitely a bit more risk involved than an electrical testing business that I looked at. But the level of excitement that I felt when looking at this business versus other more steady, slow growing businesses was day and night different. So be like, my recommendation, my biggest learning is be open to non-traditional companies, and just have a look at it and speak to as many people as possible. So I wouldn't, coming back to your question, I probably wouldn't change that much, but I only say this because I feel like I've been lucky enough to come across this company and managed to get this one over the line. I didn't have to go through submitting 5 LOIs and go through 2 or 3 due diligence processes. So I count my blessings.
Yeah, absolutely. But I guess maybe if there's anything, it would have been opening your mind to lower EBITDA businesses earlier, perhaps.
From the start. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Never say no to just looking at a deal.
And so how far did you lower the bar of EBITDA from your original 1.5 million plus target?
I looked at 500K and above.
Great. Yeah. So still, yeah, material businesses that have got, you know, some, that's going to indicate a team, you know, regular custom, correct, you know, sensible, correct, overhead base, et cetera, et cetera. So that's good. That's great. Yeah. And I would encourage many self-funded searchers to look at that bar as well. You're going to have operational involvement, but that's what you're trying to buy. So
for those, yeah, I mean, there are plenty of people also just looking to buy and build and not operate, and they would, like, it's more of an M&A activity than anything else. But I really, like, I get excited by the operating part.
Exactly. Good. So yeah, let's talk about ETA as an investment class, because we did in our original chat last year. Have you seen that space evolve? What do you think is making it increasingly compelling to alternative asset class investors?
You have to look at the whole, I suppose, investment class or investment ecosystem. If you look at the S&P 500 in particular, even after everything that's happened, it's close to its peak in terms of price earnings. And so it's hard to see how over the next decade it will perform as well as over the past decade. So you put that aside, then there's so many possible stories like mine to be made, whether that's self-funded or in the traditional space. And a lot of investors have realized that, and where you probably know more about this, Gareth, than me, but I see more and more individual investors, usually people that have successfully sold their own company, but they have this wealth of knowledge built over time, and they're setting up funds of search funds that for people with spare cash, I believe are very good vehicles to invest in, because you spread your risk immensely, because they plan to invest in, I mean, depending on the fund size, but they might invest in 40, 50 searchers and then do 10 to 25 follow-up investments, and the usual search fund economics apply to these. And so your IRR over a 5 or 10 year period should, if all goes well and if it's well managed, should be pretty decent. There are a few of those. I think I'm just talking to a few people at the moment. I believe in France, there are a few that are being set up at the moment. So yeah, a lot of things are happening in the space for sure. And again, I'm not the riskiest person. So having the ability to invest in search without having to pick individual winners or losers, kind of satisfies that need without doing a lot of work. And of course your return will be slightly smaller than if you would only invest in the good deals, but that's by nature. So
yep, that's fund investing, and it's an exciting time for funds in this space, most certainly. So just before we wrap up, looking ahead to the future of Vistafolio, I know it's, you know, still first half of the year of the year one. Where would you like to see it be in sort of 5 years' time? What's your ambitions for it? I guess sell a note paid off early, and then.
Yeah, I mean it's my first, second, and third priority, right? Just making sure that I fulfill on that obligation. All the rest is sort of on the sidelines. No, I just like to solidify our position where we are. I think the products are there, and that was really the bread and butter of what the previous owner brought to the table. He was an award-winning horticulturist, so landscaper. So he knows plants inside out, and they're second to none. So it's really, how do we build a bigger commercial engine around the company, making sure we are selling more into geographies like the Middle East, for example, where, I mean, we sell artificial green walls and plants and trees and hedges. That stuff is hard to grow there. Not impossible, but it's hard and expensive to grow. So it's kind of a natural market for us where we're already active, but we can do a lot more. And same with countries like Germany, France. So it's really, and then of course there's our home market where we're scratching the surface as well. So it's steady growth without doing stupid things. And then we'll see where we end in 5 years. Hard to say. There's so many variables. But I'd like to think we can double this business in 5 years, if not triple. But we'll have to speak again then to see how far we've come.
I'll hold you to that. But I'm sure that you'll deliver something on the road to those results. Most certainly, you're a steady pair of hands with some amazing career history. So I think growth is definitely on the cards. And I'd love you to come back and tell us how much growth you've achieved and how in a few years' time. That'd be great, Seb. Yeah, we'll wrap up. Thank you so much, Seb, for the kindness that you've shown in sharing your incredible journey and your experience with us today. It's really kind of brought home the realities of what's possible in search and then what life is like in the first few months following an acquisition getting over the line. So really has been inspiring to hear your passion for the business, and I'm sure our listeners will join me in wishing you well. Listeners, you can connect with Seb via his LinkedIn profile, and obviously can visit Vistafolia on their website at vistafolia.com to find out a bit more about the business that that Seb now runs. We're hoping Seb's going to join us on the 18th of June as one of our exemplar successful searchers who have managed to get acquisitions done in recent months at the symposium we're running on the 18th of June for serial acquirers and searchers and holdco builders. So that's in central London on the 18th of June. Visit serialacquirer.uk to get your day pass and meet myself, Seb, and almost 200 other searcher acquirers and investors in the space. Looking forward to seeing you there. So great, Seb, we wish you well. And thanks very much. I know you're heading off around the world soon. So we'll leave you to your travels, but do come back again and tell us how you got on, and we'll see you on the 18th. Thank you everybody for now, and keep on crunching.
Thanks very much, Gareth.